This is the Dairy Download, brought to you by Bloomling Associates and the International Dairy Foods Association, where we offer extra sharp market and policy insights on dairy. I'm your host, Phil Plourd.
And I'm your co-host, Kathleen Wolfley.
Today's episode is all about volatility. And man, oh man, do we see some volatility out there today, Kathleen?
I woke up this morning feeling seasick, and I think I'm seasick once again after watching these markets trade.
Yeah, just another day, just another diamond block cheddar cheese. We've sort of become immune to what historically would have been pretty big moves, but when we see 30-cent moves from week to week in some of these products, an 11-cent day is like, it's just a regular old Wednesday.
Yeah, it's Wednesday. Our sponsor for today's show is the good folks at Stanpak. For 70 years, Stanpak has been manufacturing milk and ice cream packaging for companies located throughout North America. Contact Stanpak and experience their legendary service.
Thanks, Stanpak, and thanks, Kathleen. So, with all this volatility, where are we now?
Today, we find ourselves with block cheddar prices up to $2.33 a pound. That's up 17 cents on the week. Barrels finished at $1.61 a pound, down about 6 cents. Butter finished a penny higher to $1.51. CME spot non-fat dry milk prices closed at $1.07 per pound, up 2 cents on the week. So Phil, in your opinion, what do you think the most important things are this week in the dairy markets?
Well, you know, apart from the volatility, I've been thinking a lot about school and how 60% of school children, K through 12, are said to be at home learning virtually in some way, shape, or form as the year begins. And I think that definitely is having an impact on milk consumption as well as maybe cheese consumption in schools. You know, about 8% of fluid milk consumption happens in schools. And when the kids are at home, we're not really sure what's going to happen. A lot of school districts are offering pickup programs and trying to feed kids and families. And, you know, you would expect to see some of that volume roll into the retail space. But I think it's a big unknown right now. And I think it's a very distinct possibility that in the weeks ahead, as kids remain home learning virtually to some extent, that there's going to be weeks where we say, wow, it seems like there's a lot of milk around. And the answer is going to be that there's a lot of milk around because not as much is being consumed in schools or going to cheese plants to make products for the school programs. What about you, Kathleen?
I guess to me, the thing that I keep mulling over in my head is this new Michigan cheese plant. It's set to open here in the next month or so. And granted, it's not going to be up to full capacity on day one, but it's an 8 million pound a day plant. And that accounts for about 15% of Mideast milk supply, which, man, oh man, it seems like that could put a pretty big dent in just how milk is moving across the or moving within the Mideast market, as well as potentially into the Midwest marketplace.
Yeah, 8 million pounds of milk is no small volume. It'll take a while for that plant to get there, but based on everything that we hear, it's going to be there by sometime in the second quarter of next year with a ramp up between October and then. So, 8 million is a big number. You know, we do like numbers. What's your stat of the week, Kathleen?
Well, Phil, I am so glad you asked that. You know that we love numbers here in Bloomling Land. And my number, my stat of the week is 46. 46 lots of butter traded in Chicago yesterday. That is the most for any day going back to November 2004. And for those of your dairy dorks that are sitting out there, you may recall that we didn't really start trading butter on a daily basis until 2006. So that was back when we were trading only three times a week. So that's my stat of the week.
So let me ask you a question, Kathleen. During this pandemic, this extended stay at home for everybody, have you bought any enhancements for your home, any patio furniture, anything in the building and materials space?
I have. I replaced a couple windows at my house this year.
I can tell you that I have a grill sitting about 50 feet to my right that's awaiting assembly. That was my big purchase here this week. And my stat of the week involves just that building material and garden place center sales were up 14% year over year in the month of August and are up 10% year to date. And so that came out of the Census Bureau retail sales report this morning. The overall numbers in that report were modestly disappointing with 0.6% growth between the months of July and August. But we did see retail sales up overall on a year-over-year basis, driven in no small part by our desire to trick out our homes that we're sticking around more these days.
Hey, Phil, just curious, out of that report, what did it say about restaurant sales?
Well, restaurant sales did continue to improve. Dollar volume was up 5% from July to August, but sales were still down 15% year over year. Grocery stores down 1% on the month, but up 10% year over year, back to that sort of stay-at-home theme. We're going to put some grocery store-bought food on the new grill here pretty soon.
So I keep thinking about, what does the next couple months look like? What does the next couple years look like? And I've decided that my fearless prediction for this week is that despite all the volatility in the cheese market, I don't know as though it's going to stick around. As we look toward October, I wonder if these higher $2+ cheese prices tell buyers in October, or at least as the calendar flips to October, you know what, maybe I'll take a step back, particularly those that are buying on a trailing month average. It's kind of a bit of a big bite to chew if you're going from sub $2 pricing to a big plus $2 pricing from September to October. So there's my fearless prediction for this week. We're going to see a drop in prices as we go into October.
All right. And I'm going to give you my fearless prediction, which is a data point which might help get us there. Next week, we get the latest cold storage numbers for August. Typically, cheese stocks drop between July and August. I think that we are going to see a much smaller than normal decline in those stocks. And I would say that there's even a reasonable possibility that we will see stocks have increased between those 2 months. It's kind of what the market was saying as it fell apart in the month of August. We'll see if it comes true.
Hey, Phil, let's go to our first guest, Dr. Marin Bozic.
All right, I'll bring my Larry King microphone closer to me. Should be good now.
Minneapolis, you're next. Go ahead.
Today on the Dairy Download.
And we are back with Marin Bozic, one of the smartest, most provocative, and busiest people working in and around the dairy industry. Marin, welcome to the Dairy Download.
Always good to visit with you, Phil.
So here's our first question for you today. When do you sleep? What are your official jobs and responsibilities these days?
Oh, whenever my baby lets me. He's going to be 1 year old tomorrow, but he's not acting it yet. So seldom is the one word answer.
I guess, you know, the question I want to start with today is, what are some of the structural factors that engender or exacerbate dairy market volatility?
Right. When I talk about it with folks, when I try to teach them, I say that it can be summarized in this way. If the price of milk goes down, people won't have two breakfasts. And if the price of milk goes up, Bessie will not have her calf in less than 9 months. So the inelasticity on both supply and demand make for an explosive situation where a small disturbance in either demand or supply can make the price dip by 20-30% or skyrocket to the levels that we haven't seen before.
And do you think perishability plays a role in that? Is that one factor in all that?
Yeah. Of course, yes.
So yeah, thinking about that a little bit, how do you think the industry should address volatility? Is that something that we should be looking at on an industry-wide basis using some sort of different system, or on a firm level using conventional or other risk management tools, or both?
Well, both. The analogy that came to my mind as I was thinking about the questions that you sent me over the weekend is that the centers of price discovery, GDT, CME spot, they're really like nerve endings of the dairy organism or the dairy supply chains. Both the federal orders and the spot market are something that we love to complain in the industry. But the spot market has gone down to $1 per pound and $3 per pound this year. To me, that's a signal that as a nerve ending, it's doing its job. It's communicating the scarcity or relative abundance very, very quickly and in a dramatic fashion.
So, Marin, our friend Mike McCauley recently wrote an article for Hordes Dairymen suggesting that a daily price reporting model, something like cattle, might be useful for the dairy industry. What do you think about that?
I think that there is something that we could look into. There is some merit to that, but what I'm concerned about is an echo chamber where previous survey results serve as a basis for pricing milk that is then surveyed again. And then we had that problem with some dairy commodities in the past where we did not have an external source of price discovery. So I think that the system that we have right now, that when information flows from the market of last resort, which is the CME spot market, to the weekly surveys, NDPSR, to the monthly announced prices. There's a lot of wisdom in that system. If anything, it has to be complemented by, for example, with a two-tier pricing on a processor level where the marginal milk is priced differently than the base milk. That could perhaps address some of the volatility issues and communicate the signals stronger as the marginal incentive is stronger for producers to adjust production. But I would not be keen to completely disband the current system. I think there's a lot of wisdom in it. It's just that it's incomplete and perhaps needs to be complemented by other instruments.
So, Maren, you've played a crucial role in developing the Dairy Revenue Protection Program that operates under the federal crop insurance umbrella. It sure looks successful from where I sit. Have you been surprised by the uptake, and what would make the program even better?
At this point, we have about 30% of the milk covered for the third quarter of the year. Probably the fourth quarter of the year will come anywhere between 27 and 32% of milk covered as well. In just 2 years, I think that's a pretty strong uptake, pretty strong adoption rate. I think what's needed next, Phil, is the wider adoption in terms of number of producers. For this program to maintain its long-term legitimacy, we cannot have just a few thousand producers use it. We need to get to 10, 15,000 producers using the system. And one of the prerequisites for that, of course, is the education of crop insurance agents throughout the country, and then also enabling faster binding of endorsements. My dream is to reduce that to 3 to 5 minutes over the next 2 years by facilitating the information transmittal mechanism between the mobile app and the AIP authorized insurance providers, where agents can do it in 5 minutes and move on. Then everybody will have the incentive to cater to 100 cow dairy, to 200 cow dairies.
You know, we figure that DMC covers most 200, 225 cow farms adequately. So I think that, is it possible that some of the skew towards the larger farms and the fewer numbers of farms participating in DRP has to do with DMC's sufficient insulation for smaller farms?
I think that's certainly part of it. I think that's certainly part of it. We also do need to remind farmers that they are allowed to use these programs concurrently.
I guess more so, does it complicate risk management?
Right. So the a lot of grief this summer over negative PPDs and basis risk that introduces, where class prices are used for hedging or instruments based on class prices. So if we can reduce the severity and frequency of large negative PPDs, then federal orders will serve, then the risk management under federal orders will be smoother going forward. So that's going to be one of the topics next year as we head towards the next hearing for federal orders. But, you know, if some companies decide to produce the product because of the way that it's priced through federal orders and because of the way that influences their bottom line, for example, by producing more barrels and depressing the price of barrels, that would be the case where federal orders, as they currently are, could potentially increase volatility, particularly for those producers whose milk does go to a barrel cheese plant. So we do need to look into elements of the current federal orders that perhaps encourage disorderly marketing, not pointing fingers at anyone, but you know, certainly there is some incentive present in the current market to do that. But my main point with federal orders is that they've been around for a very long time, and we should not throw the baby out with the bathwater.
So, Mar, another question that comes to mind as we talk about government role in dairy markets through federal orders, what do you think about the recent round of government purchases? How has that played into the volatility conversation?
Right. So I think that in order to answer that question, it's not sufficient to go back to May or April. We need to go back to November 2016, where it was Michigan, Wisconsin, and Pennsylvania that delivered the Republicans the presidency. Those are all three large dairy states. So for the current president to be competitive in 2020, he needs to win Pennsylvania, Wisconsin, and Michigan. In other words, if he wins those three states, he will have a mandate for another 4 years. I think that's part of the issue that was driving the dairy pricing dynamics throughout 2020. I think we are in a political cycle. We used to talk about a three-year cycle driven by heifer biology, etc. I think we are currently in a political cycle in dairy, which I would say to folks, don't learn the wrong lesson here, because in 2021, there are no elections and we will still have all the supply and demand issues to contend with.
All right, Maren, thank you very much. Always great to talk to you. If folks want to learn more about Maren's work, you can go to marenbozic.com. Thanks again, Maren, for being part of the Dairy Download.
Thank you, Kathleen and Phil. Always good to talk with you.
That's the industry angle. What about the view from Washington? Let's see what Dr. Joe Glauber has to say.
We are really excited today to be with Joe Glauber. Joe is a senior research fellow at the International Food Policy Research Institute. Before that, he spent 3 decades with USDA, the last several years as chief economist. Joe, welcome to the Dairy Download.
Thanks very much.
So the government has been busy spending money via direct payments, commodity safety net programs, and risk management efforts this year. It's been a difficult year, but do you think that we're sending the right message to agricultural producers with the proliferation of payments? Is there some sort of risk of discouraging producers from using market-based tools to manage risk? Are we creating potential for oversupply?
Yeah, that's a good question, Phil. I think you have to put these payments in context to the last 3 years. And I would distinguish what's been paid out under COVID compared to what was paid out under the Market Facilitation Payments Program, which were, of course, trade aid payments. And I would argue there that those things were reacting to poor policy choices and sort of compensating farmers for what I would view as poor trade policy. But COVID has had a big effect on agriculture. There's no question. Now, you may argue that these payments may have overpaid some producers, underpaid others. I think that points to the problem of how difficult it is to tailor these payments to specific needs. But as you say, it's a lot of money. And I think that people next year are going to be looking at whether or not these funds are going to continue, particularly as the tail of COVID lasts longer than a year.
What are you expecting to see next?
The CARES Act, as we saw in CFAP, not all that money has been spent. And I think that's an issue. You have payment limits that are affecting some producers. You have other issues. But again, what I see is that certainly the administration, all signs are that we'll see a new program be announced within the next 10 days or so.
I guess shifting gears and thinking about the consumer, clearly the pandemic has created a situation where a lot of people have needed quite a bit of help. USDA went the route of creating new programming through the Farmers to Families Food Box program rather than leaning on existing infrastructure like SNAP. What do you think, in your opinion, are the pros and cons of this type of approach?
Yeah, that's a great question, Kathleen. We have programs that address producer losses. And we certainly had programs on the ground like SNAP and emergency food assistance programs that affect consumers. I would have rather seen the monies go into there rather than creating new programs that require new bureaucracies.
So with that in mind, I'm guessing if you were in your old role as chief economist and were advising the secretary, would you have mentioned, hey, let's try to do one thing at a time? Or what kind of counsel would you have offered the secretary in March and April when things were kind of coming off the rails?
Yeah, that's a fair question. And it would be easy for me to sit here right now and say, oh, of course, I would have warned him of all these things. But in fact, I think COVID caught a lot of people off guard, obviously. And, it seemed like all of us went from, kind of normal lives in early March to very changed lives by early April. And to come up with programs on the fly like USDA has had to do, I think that's a tough, very tough task. And it's tough to do it in a way that's equitable. I do think that in terms of the food box program, when I first heard about it, I thought this doesn't sound like a good idea. So I presume that is, I would have had the same reaction 5, 6 years ago. But, that again, that's all hindsight. It's in many respects particularly with the sort of economic downturn, what you really want is people spending money, right? And so trying to get money out there is a good thing. And, these sorts of programs, even when they're inefficient, they serve some purpose.
I mean, is there anything novel that you might have had in mind or anything leverage what we were going to do?
I do think, I feel pretty strongly that the one thing that I think I would have liked to have seen in these packages is a bigger budget put in for SNAP. We saw that with 2008, 2009. That really helped. It really helped families rebound.
So, Joe, I know that you work pretty closely with your local food bank, and I'm just curious, thinking about these food box programs and just the monies that have gone to consumers to to help them get through this time. Can you talk a little bit about your ground level experience, how these funds are being deployed at the ground level?
So I started, you know, in April or so when I was working at home and just bored and thought, well, I really need to do something. And so I started volunteering at the food bank. And to see it go from, you know, sort of one shift a day or two shifts a day to three shifts a day now and work. I was working yesterday and the line speed was so fast putting these boxes together. We were just assembling box after box. Everyone was exhausted by the end. And then there was a whole other shift coming in at 5 p.m. to do another shift. So the demand is out there, I guess, is the point I'm trying to make.
So going back to the USDA angle or the government angle, I know that we've spent a lot of time this year telling customers that they shouldn't confuse political programs for economic programs. For someone like the chief economist at USDA, how hard is it to balance those imperatives?
You know, oftentimes there are times at USDA where, you know, when I was there, you would discuss policy, debate it, analyze various options, present those to the secretary, decision would be made. I think what's happening here is the time frame on these things is really, really tight. And I look at something like the market facilitation program back in 2019, and remember that was announced out of the White House in the middle of planning season. So if you think if you're going to start announcing payment rates and other things, you have the potential of really disrupting markets, because only about it, I think at the time that program was announced, only about 45-50% of the corn was planted at that point. And I think the chief economist's office did a good job, the best job they could have, in trying to really neutralize all of that and set up, you know, a sort of generic payment rates per county.
That leads me to another question, thinking about the market facilitation program. How do you see trade policy unfolding in the months ahead, years ahead?
I'm a big believer in the importance of trade for U.S. agriculture. Countries around the world, WTO members, are concerned about the future and want to work with the U.S. in terms of getting something that brings reforms to the WTO, brings reforms to the dispute settlement mechanism at the WTO, which has been unfortunately paralyzed. And that's a system that has worked very, very well for U.S. agriculture. We've won most of the cases we've taken there, very important. Yet now with the appellate body stymied, there's a real potential of undermining the whole system there. I think there's an opportunity, again, for the U.S. to work with countries, because I think countries want to work with the U.S. And I think that, I think it's important for us to step up and show that leadership again.
So just stepping back away from some of the current swirl and madness, are you bullish on U.S. agriculture over the next 5-10 years?
Yeah, I am. I mean, I think that understand that the global demand's growing. You know, for most of the commodities that we produce, we have strong export potential. I mean, look at dairy. I mean, who would have thought 20 years, 25 years ago, we would be talking about dairy export markets quite the way we do now? I mean, these were essentially surplus markets where we dump product. Now they're, you know, important markets for us and growing markets. And I think we need to be in those markets like China, like other Asia markets. And I think those are markets that we're competitive in.
Well, Joe, it's been an absolute delight to speak with you today. Thank you for being with us on the Dairy Download.
No, thank you. This has been great.
That's a wrap for today's show. As always, we want to thank our production team, Matt Herrick, Michael Gooden, and Andrew Jerome at IDFA, and Corey Romero over here at Blimling & Associates.
Again, a huge thanks to our sponsor, Standpack. Contact Standpack and experience their legendary service. Thanks for listening to the Dairy Download. Until next time, stay sharp.